Welcome back. Good to have you all with us today. Link Ray Bourne today, 1929. That's his song, Run, Chicken, Run. We're going to hear a panel that I moderated last weekend at Everyman Theater for part of our World of the Plays series. We talk about the current production there at Everyman. By the way, meet Vera Stark by the incredible Lynn Nottage, one of our most prolific and amazing playwrights in America today. The play is about Vera Stark, an African-American woman who was a domestic to a white movie star in the 30s, but Stark is also an actress. And she's cast along with her employer in a Hollywood film. It traces the mix of race and gender and the arts from the 30s to the 70s. An amazing play. So I know you'll enjoy this conversation. To my left is Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, who's been a frequent guest on the Mark Steiner Show. She is a PhD in mass communications. She's a professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And they don't have the name of your book here, and I always forget the entire title.
Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair and Body Politics in Africana Communities. That's why he forgets.
It's a very long title, but it really does fit this discussion. And to my right is Otis Cortez Ramsey Zoe, who teaches at Howard University, a lecturer in theater arts there. And he is the Associate Artistic Director of Banished. His work has been everywhere across the country in many festivals and places. And an amazing playwright at the very end there who coordinated us moving in so our clothes would look right. Thank you very much. I deeply appreciate that because I don't have a sense of that at all. Jacqueline Lawton is with us. She's an amazing playwright. And she's written so many things that after I started reading her work the first time she was here, I was just very taken. And I'm really thrilled that she's back on this panel again one more time. So let's just begin, shall we? And I say you were at one of the original readings of the play, right? Do I have that right, Kimberly?
I was in 2008.
Right. And this play has had a bunch of iterations and it's done slightly different ways when it's done. The funny thing about this play for me is, as Kim and I were texting back and forth today, is you know because of the whole world we were joking about in the back room when you first look at this play and start Googling it and you see Vera Stark, there's a whole world that has been created to make you think that Vera Stark was a real person. The Peter Bogdanovich documentary that is done very seriously, you know, the webpage about her life. But even that is like an amalgam of what the reality was for women like that in the 30s and where Lynn came from. So I'm curious, when you look at this play, how did that speak to you as reality from that moment? Because you all are steeped in that history. Do we start?
I'm starting. Jacqueline? Okay. Yeah. It feels that it could be any of the stories of the African American women who we know about in Hollywood. It could be any of their stories. We do know more about, say, Dorothy Dandridge than some of the others. I think mostly because she came later. But I think there's a couple of websites for Vera Starks and I think you could easily find yourself going down a rabbit hole of trying to find out who these women were. A lot of it has to do with the fact that our stories just weren't recorded, weren't documented. A lot of these women did have those kind of nameless roles, these roles that they took because they desperately wanted to be actors, but weren't necessarily parts that could move them forward in a viable way. Like the story of Vera Starks is really the Hattie McDaniel story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so many people's stories, but it could easily be the Hattie McDaniel story. No one expected her to play this role so well that they had to give her an Academy Award. She was just that extraordinary. And no one ever expected that. No one expected to walk away saying, yikes, you are all going to lose out to a maid. And not just a maid, but to a mammy. So I think it could be any of the stories for these women.
And there's a thought that I'm thinking concerning representation and the plays and the complexity and nuances of the portrait of the character. And I think that there's something that Lynn is playing with in this world that has to do with comedy and how comedy functions, and also the different types of comedy. When we look at the first act, which really is playing in the terrain of the 1930s Hollywood film, but it's also dramatically there's a conversation about different types of comedy, particularly the sentimental comedy, but how the sentimental comedy is commenting on sort of the restoration style of comedy that came before, right? Where there's this tension around vice and virtue, but it really is an incredible send-up of that. And you take with that then this sort of Hollywood comedic story that's operating within this dramatic play, and then you take Vera, who's also using comedy in the way that we recognize comedy can be used as a type of social critique, right? Yeah. So that we use comedy in order to have conversations about things that are very important. And she is infusing her portrait of the maid that she plays in The Belle of the South. And so that there's something that's complicated there. And I think that it's that story that gets us to the point where the actress plays the maid so incredibly well that we have to give her an award, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that it has something to do about the confluence of all of these types of ways of expressing comedy and playing comedy. And I think I'll say more about comedy later because that's the world I'm thinking of.
And comedy's going to be one of the themes I want to talk about in the course and how it works, because Kimberly has some thoughts on that as well.
Overall thoughts. But I wanted to say that what I thought was most interesting about Lynn Nottage's work in this iteration is that it makes the evolution of black women in film a contemporary issue, even though it is set in the 1930s for us to watch what her what Vera Stark's experience was in the 30s, trying to be this Hollywood star, that we're still dealing with so many of those issues in present day. And so it makes you think about those experiences of so many of the women currently. So you think about some of the comments that Viola Davis mentioned when she was playing in The Help, right? And the fact that she received so much criticism for that particular role, but how she embraced it in a particular way that was also acknowledged, right? Because she was nominated for an Academy Award. So we see these iterations that have changed the role of black women in film, but we also see them in many ways being some of the same issues that Vera Stark had to deal with in the 30s. And then recognizing, of course, it's not until early 2000s that a black woman is finally acknowledged by the Academy Awards as a best actor, actress in a film, not supporting, because we know we have to give Hattie McDaniels her credit. But it's not until the early 2000s when we see Halle Berry playing in a very problematic role for many, right, in Monsters Ball, to actually be acknowledged by the Academy for her role. I also thought, just as a quick tangent, I thought it was really interesting when I did a response to Nottage's screening of the play back in 2008. The play actually stopped at this conversation that happens on the television show. And so I thought the addition of the panelists, where the professors and the playwrights come up to talk about and reflect on that particular script, was that particular segment of the play, was really interesting because it reflected similarly to what we were doing back in 2008, where after the reading took place of the play, there were a panel of professors that came forward to say, let's talk about Vera Stark. Mm-hmm. And we reflected back on it, and it was really interesting to see that incorporated in some way into the overall production.
So we have a bunch of things to kind of dance through here in the next 45 minutes or so. So let me start with the period of time that the play took place in, from the 30s to the 70s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the part of her inspiration was Teresa Harris, who played in films in the 30s and stood up to Barbara Stanwyck and stole the scene in many movies that she was in. The people like Nina Mae McKinney and others who were these women who played in, black women who played in lots of films. I mean, when I looked at the list of films these women played in, came right out of the play. I mean, they played in 70, 80, 90 films apiece, and then kind of mastered their money and watched how they spent their money and lived a life of creative life in a period where what they could do with that creativity on film was diminishing. But what they were allowed to do. So that to me is a fascinating idea. The idea that she wanted to explore what these women did and what happens to them in the modern era and what they have to say to us now. That's something that's, to me, that's kind of the power piece. I just wonder how you all view that.
Well, I will say that the play, for me, we meet Vera and we meet Gloria, 30s, and then again in the 70s. But that panel discussion is contemporary.
Yeah, that's contemporary,
you know?
Right.
So we're actually spanning, in terms of race representation, like 100 years. Or, you know, not 100 years, but it's 80 years, which I think is really quite compelling to think about, that we're looking at even those panelists through a lens of race representation, which I found a bit challenging at times.
What do you mean?
The idea of the way the panelists themselves were portrayed, this idea of race representation was challenging for me. It felt caricature. And I think that Lynn is doing something even more subversive than I think we're even really aware of, because we're focused so much on Vera, what Vera's doing. She's even taken us into, so in the 30s, you know, 50s, Black people on stage could only be these servant roles because that's what the world allowed us to be. So limited imagination of what I could be was then portrayed on film. But then when you get to a place of contemporary society where we're allowed to be more than just, because society allows us to be doctors, lawyers, professors, et cetera, there is still a representation of what we sound like, look like, behave like. Professors rolling on the floor, professors breaking into spoken word in the most fascinating way. I have never seen in my life a professor do this. I haven't. It may be out there, but I've never seen it, you know?
And so how do you think I felt as being the light-skinned Black woman with the locks at the panel in 2008, sitting watching
there
in 2014 that particular
how
character?
How did you feel?
I had some issues. And I wondered what we thought about professors and how, but I also knew what she was doing was taking pieces of a lot of people create that for us so that it was dramatic in that particular space. And I think it was needed, again, in many ways, and this is one of the criticisms that we are constantly dealing with in terms of representations as a whole for African Americans, is what is an appropriate representation? Because in many ways, you know, I hear, you know, my students constantly talking to me about what's problematic with Scandal, right? But yet it's a very popular and successful show that we're embracing in various ways, but people immediately start talking about some of the roles or the way in which that particular character lives out her life. And I oftentimes push back to say, but what about the complexity of human beings in general? Is that not consistent to who we are as human beings, that we aren't just this monolithic particular portrayal of something? And would we have ever seen such a character on screen 15 years ago, even, with that level of complexity? And I don't know if we would. I don't know if we would.
Well, do you think do you think that, I'm not thinking about what both of you just said, and the period that where the play ends in the early 70s, this is a period where in the intellectual circles and Black intellectual circles especially, it was a very volatile period. Yep. I mean, segregation had just ended.
Yeah.
The explosion was just happening. There were lots of things happening from good times to Soul Train to Roots.
Jefferson.
You know, I mean, this was an explosive moment. So, I mean, I think in some ways she got that period, and she got the angst between people trying to figure out what the past meant and what the present means and where that takes us. I think she kind of nailed that. I don't know.
No, absolutely. And I think that you do justice to sort of identify it as sort of this progression along this particular arc, right, that takes us from the 30s into the contemporary moment. And we look at what she's examining in the 70s, I think that there's definitely a conversation about those types of shows, the good times, the place where humor or comedy is rooted in sort of the comedy of what is the comedy of circumstances, the comedy of poverty, right? In particular, I'm thinking about Good Times, where everything got worse, right? The situation never got better, and we were there was a constant state of decline, but there was a particular type of joy in that. Right. And then as we progress and we get to the figures in the contemporary moment, she's really living in the space of the artist scholar, which is something that we actually see in the realm of performance studies, but it allows her to do, just as Dr. Moffitt says, to create characters or people who are containers for contradictions. Right. And I think that that's one of the most interesting things. And it's actually then she's creating characters, even when they're deeply problematic, are much more complex than we are actually allowed to see. And so I think that it's also definitely intentional then, the structure of the discussion, right? That the discussion actually sort of crescendos into a point where nobody's actually really listening to each other. Mm. There's a lot of cutting off, right? Someone's going to make a point, and let me stop you right there. Let me hold that, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's also something I think that Lynn is saying where even the conversation becomes a critique of the conversation, right?
Oh, yeah,
what does it
yeah.
mean that we're having conversations about race, right? Okay. There's something in the panel that for me, the message becomes about the futility of conversation, right? The conversation perhaps is not as purposeful as action, because what follows that moment, right? The panelists are talking, and then everything breaks down, and then we go back into the footage. Mm-hmm. And the characters walk out of the footage because they need to do the screen test, and they have a conversation. In that conversation, an action is decided upon. Right? So we're actually going to commit an action on screen that perhaps only you and I know, but this is actually where progress happens. Right. It's not in the talking.
Right. Well said.
Yeah, yep. Well said. I think that's the kind of thing, in some ways, only playwrights can do, is to get to those kind of forces that contradict and forces so you can spread things out in front of people in ways you can't do in another medium. You can't do it in a painting, I don't think.
Sure.
I don't think you can actually do that in a poem in the same way. It's very different. Would you say that as the playwright among us?
I would say that just because it is dialogue. It is us pushing to past to where I have an ability to express what it is I'm trying to say, what I mean, mm-hmm. because I now have to do. So we have to show a moment of action, right? You have to have conflict. But I think what is really powerful about, I was saying to Catherine, who was a guest of us, I was like, I wonder if the audience here is going to want us to do that, what they saw on stage. Do they want us to, like, break down and talk over each other? And
I'm not rolling on the floor.
I know, right? You know, it's like, I wonder if that's the expectation. And what I think is, I appreciate about what if that possibly is an expectation is that when you care so deeply and passionately about something, you do your words are so moving fast outside of you, and when you've talked about it for so long. So I think as a playwright, what she does masterfully is she captures our inability to talk about race, our inability to dig deeper under this thing that we know we need to get to. We know we need to have an understanding amongst each other, amongst other races, but we can't do it. And talking isn't enough. Action can be misinterpreted. They say very specifically, no one will know. Right. No one will know what we're doing. But it doesn't matter. We know. It matters. It matters. But there's no way to make it matter without betraying the truth of the situation, which would then crumble her entire reality and life. So that's just the space. So as a playwright, and Lynn is the playwright who understands so beautifully nuance and how a single snap can break down an entire world. Mm-hmm. She's incredible that way. And I think that's why this play goes from the 1930s to the contemporary, where I'm like, oh my gosh, are they going to expect us to do this? Right. Because she gets so palpably what's real, what's present, what matters so much to people right now.
So, go ahead, Rob.
I was just going to say, and I think that along those lines, what she's also, of course, playing with is always challenging our expectation, right?
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think that this idea then that she is constantly discomforting the comfortable, the comforted maybe is a better way to say that, where if we think we know what academic discourse looks like, we think we know what etiquette looks like when people are engaged in these conversations, she's actually going to make that complicated to the point where we should have some kind of problem with something that we're seeing, even if it's absolutely hilarious, right?
Sure.
But it's in that place where she sort of makes us uncomfortable that we really are challenged to kind of examine not just the issues, but how the issues are being discussed.
Yeah.
One of the things we talked about earlier, you mentioned in the conversation we had this morning, and you mentioned in our texting this morning, was the question of comedy and how comedy was used.
Yeah.
And who was laughing and who wasn't laughing, and why people are laughing, and what are we laughing at?
And I think that was what was most interesting to me, is what are we laughing at? Because there was, for me, as I watched last night, in the beginning of the play, there seemed to be nervous laughter, but it seemed to become more and more guttural, where people were really enjoying it. And I guess as someone who is immersed in this as a reality for their research, you know, for me it was tired. I was like, okay, here we go again through this process.
It was tired.
The way the comedy flowed. But it was, just as we talked about this morning, it was certainly in context to that time period that that's what worked. And I was fascinated, though, that for it to be comedy that worked in that time period, how it seemed so accessible to folks in a contemporary audience. So as an example, when you show segments of Amos and Andy, everyone's a little uncomfortable about when to laugh. You know, there's this kind of nervous pause of, should I
laugh? Is it really funny?
Whereas I didn't notice that in this same context. And I wonder if that's about Lynn Nottage's gift to be able to pull off for folks, or if we were having some nervous laughter in the beginning and then just got to a point of feeling comfortable that we're going to enjoy this because it feels comfortable. It feels like humor that I can connect to. When it's out of, again, out of a particular era, that's a very different form or different type of comedy that I think we experience in contemporary audiences now.
See, I don't think it's, oh.
Oh, I was... Well, I think that it's about the level of commentary that's embedded in the play, right? Particularly that first scene when it opens. Because Lynn lets us know that while we are to take everything seriously, we're also going to be commenting on it as we're going along, right? So once we get to the moment where Gloria cannot remember the line and everything breaks down and she sort of adds her critique on top of the role that she's attempting to play with dead seriousness, I think that that creates the space then where the audience now knows it is okay to laugh at everything,
right?
Nothing
right.
is sacred.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, that's the same spot where I felt like there was a shift that took place, where there were a few moments or a few individuals that had a response, but it wasn't until then that there was this shift where everyone was like, okay, I can do this.
So for me, I never got comfortable laughing. I never got comfortable laughing. And I think it stems from three places, one of which is that my mother worked as a nurse, worked as a home health care worker, clean house. She's done all of these things, and she did these things to put food on our table. So when Viola Davis had to say, do we always have to be noble, when in defense of choosing that role, which she did so magnanimously and so beautifully, I said to myself, anyone who works hard to put food on their table is noble, and they deserve to have their story told. And I will write a character who is a maid, as well as I'll write a character who's a lawyer, with the same amount of honor and integrity. So that's first. So that's me as a playwright honoring stories, which is why it was hard as an audience member to laugh. Because then I go back to the second point, which is when I was an undergrad, I was an actor, and I stopped being an actor because I was only really getting cast as like Tituba and slave roles, and I speak like this. I speak because I am from East Texas, and I knew that I wanted to be an actor, and I knew that I couldn't be an actor. I felt I couldn't be an actor, sounding as though I was from East Texas, so I took elocution classes. And I was told, and this is why this didn't stop in the 70s or the 30s, it's still happening now, where actors are told, you're not black enough, we need this more, I don't know, urban, and that's code for, So, come on now, people. So when I see Vera imagining that she's myself, or imagining that she's the brilliant Donna Ursula, being told, in order to play this part, you've got to contort and exaggerate and shift and not be yourself, that was incredibly, that was painful for me. And then the third part is the which goes back to this contemporary sense, which is that this is still happening. Those shows that get green-lighted, whether it's on the CW or the shows that are not network television, when you look at, and it's mostly by Tyler Perry, when you look at those roles, those characters, there's a certain characterization, a certain exaggeration of who they have to be in the world as African Americans. This has not stopped. This has not changed. So that's why, for me, this was a challenge to slip into. It's okay to laugh at this, because there are people who are still paying bills, shifting, exaggerating, and molding themselves into a caricature so they can act, or that they can write, or so they can just be in the world. So that's my response.
So, okay, hello. I'll wait.
Well, and I think that one thing then that is interesting, if we're talking about, because race is a visual conversation, and those expectations that come with walking in a room and being seen as phenotypically black, and then therefore being asked to perform one's blackness or to perform mm-hmm. one's blackness to a greater extent, what we ultimately find that we are watching then is, for all of the women on stage, mm-hmm. every one of them is a black woman, right? So then this question about the limits okay. or the expectations on what a black woman can perform, we are looking at Gloria, and the whole time, you know, we are looking, quote unquote, at a white woman, but we're actually looking at a black woman, right?
Right.
You know, so I think that there's
who's
something.
Who's playing a white woman?
Who's playing a white woman,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But that can't be talked about in the film, right? According to the producer.
Or it can't be talked about in the film, can't be talked about in the interview,
in life.
Right? It's like the, yeah, okay. We're best friends. Like, this could be a conversation that we have. So you gotta like knock us out. Okay.
Yes.
Open
That's
us
fine.
Up.
Yeah. Fine. You're listening to a panel I moderated last weekend at Everyman Theater as part of our World of the Play series. We talked about the show currently at Everyman called, By the Way, Meet Vera Stark by Lynn Nottage. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. You don't want to miss this. We're going to come right back to hear the rest of this incredible panel. We're hearing Transmission by Joy Division, the British band that would play their last gig with singer Ian Curtis on this day in 1980, 2 weeks before he took his own life. Welcome back. That's Leslie Gore. It's My Party, one of her most famous songs, born on this day in 1946. And this hour, we're listening to the panel that I moderated last weekend at Everyman Theater as part of their World of the Play series. We talked about the show currently at Everyman called By the Way, Meet Vera Stark by the amazing Lynn Nottage. The play is about Vera Stark, an African-American woman who works as a domestic to a white movie star in the 1930s, but she's also an actress. And she's cast along with her employer and others in this Hollywood film. Our panelists included Jacqueline Lawton, playwright and dramaturg, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, professor of American Studies at UMBC, and author of Blackberries and Red Bones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair and Body Politics in Africana Communities, and Otis Cortez Ramsey Zoe, lecturer of theater arts at Howard University and associate artistic director at Banished Productions. So that leads to, I think, the question of thinking about the title of this discussion, race and Representation, and this play that many of us have already seen, about where it is we've come to and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable and why. You know, I mean, you hear Tyler Perry speak, and Tyler Perry will say, yeah, I know a lot of people don't like what I do. They think, you know, especially they think that the intellectual things what I do is crass and stereotypes, but we have to learn to laugh. If we can't laugh and have some humor, then we're in trouble. Or people who say, we come to a place now where somebody who is a person of color can play a lascivious, evil character because the character is evil and lascivious, without it having surrounded by questions of race.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that, I mean, I think these are some of the questions they wouldn't have asked, the characters would not have wrestled with in 1960 and 70.
Hmm.
But people will wrestle with in 2015, 2020, 2025, and where this century is going to take it. Do you know what I mean?
What we need is we just need greater examples. We just need greater. So, for instance,
more examples.
Greater meaning number,
yes.
Not greater meaning value.
Absolutely.
We need more. So, for instance, there's this constant push to say that we are in a post-racial society. we are not in a post-racial society. And just because we have a black president does not mean we are in a post-racial society. Just because we have Kerry Washington playing this character does not mean we're in a post-racial society. And it's not until you've had as many black presidents, as many Latin American presidents, as many et cetera presidents, can we ever say that we're in a post-racial society. We're not even at the tipping point of coming to a place where we can have this conversation about we've moved past this certain dialogue. So in terms of greater, what I mean is more examples on, I mean, I'm not with Scandal. I'm not with that show in a way that my entire Twitter feed is and my Facebook is on Thursday night. I've watched because I am committed to Mesa Shonda, I'm committed to supporting black women, and I've watched many seasons, episodes of it. And I still frustrate with, I don't see that she's progressed. I don't see that character has progressed past what we have already seen black women play. But I am so glad that we have this amazing black woman who's commanding a national television every Thursday night. It's fantastic. It's wonderful. But I want more.
I would agree with you, Jacqueline. I'm in bed by 10 o'clock, so... Kerry Washington and I do not hang out on Thursday nights. But what I just try to acknowledge and recognize, because I've been in a space where I have attacked everything that existed in terms of our representation, including Tyler Perry, right? But I believe I have shifted to recognize that just as I affirm that we as a community are not monolithic, that means our representation should not be either.
Yes, I agree.
And so I appreciate seeing someone that has some level of complexity, like Kerry Washington's character in Scandal. That's not to suggest that I affirm it and that I believe, and so now I'm all for infidelity and none of that.
Sure.
But just recognizing that I do see a level of complexity that I haven't seen in other characters previously. But I think even for me more so, and I'm sure it has to do with the shift of being a young scholar without children to a scholar with children, that I think about these things very differently. And so when I'm thinking about race and representation, I'm thinking of it through the lens of my 8 and 10-year-old, right? Like, what images are they seeing? And so when they are watching television programs, I'm checking in with them to say, what did you think about such and such? What did you think about that character? Or who is your favorite character, on the show? So I can hear what they are seeing or experience what they are seeing. Because that's the shift that I don't think we have actually made, that we have said that now we've got access to Hollywood and entertainment in ways that we didn't in 1930s. But the representation that we are exposing our children to still are such that they come away or walk away with these very one-dimensional understandings of what blackness looks like or what they should look like. And I'm in a world where I'm trying to tell them, all of this is yours. What the hell do you want?
Exactly.
And if that's what you want, then you can have. Yep. But many of the shows that they have access to reinforce something that's counter to what I'm trying to teach. And so that's what becomes problematic with our limited representation. And that's the push that we should be making, is not sitting around waiting to see what iteration of, Real Housewives of Atlanta will experience this season. But what are our children gaining about themselves and understanding about themselves of their success trajectory in this life, in this world, if they don't have images that show them that?
Right. Which gets to your question about, so if you have this character, a person of color playing this villain character, what are the circumstances that drew his life there? And if you don't get those circumstances, then you don't get a point of understanding for who this individual is. And more often than not, you don't get the circumstances. You don't get the lack of resources, the lack of education, the external racism that led this individual to think, or limited examples that individual had for who he could be in the world.
Well,
you don't get that.
Part of it is because we make assumptions that we already understand it.
That we already understand.
Right?
Absolutely.
We understand blackness. And so all of us have the same kind of story of coming from urban settings,
right,
with certain certain entities that have influenced what has occurred in our lives. And so that explains where we are now. When we don't get to really hear the backstory of what our lived experiences are, and that in itself influences what we think about blackness in our society.
Yeah, there's something about villainy without specificity is actually the real problem, right? That when we are invested in a total narrative that allows us to see the root causes of those choices, and that the total narrative is not one that sort of caters to a set of assumptions that we already know or that are not complicated, that's what the problem is. And also, until the images on various screens, whether small or large, are as complex as the images of the people that we get to see in real life. As an instructor on the campus of Howard University, like, there's no one way to describe what blackness is, and there's so much diversity, and this is not, you know, a mind-blowing statement. We all know this. And the problem therein lies with representations where that's not what we have the opportunity to see.
So if we take from this point, I keep thinking about this play and where it ends in 1970 and where we are now, just because maybe I'm obsessed with this moment about what the 21st century is going to do. In a conversation I had with some social work students where I was lecturing a couple of weeks back, and one of the students asked me, what do we do about systemic racism, was the question. What should we do? And I said to them, I don't know what you should do. But what I can tell you is this. I think that I can identify four or five struggles in this century that I will not see the end of because I'm too old to see it. But this is going to be part of your struggle. You're going to be redefining this. It's going to be your generation's. This is the next levels of struggle to change the culture and society. And saying that to them, I was thinking about that the dynamic. Let me ask this question directly, how this fits in. The dynamic that happened in 1930 with black actors, writers, playwrights, as compared to the dynamic today, in terms of not, I mean, look, when you look at media, I don't like the vast majority of representations I see in the media. I don't care who they are, right? Because it's being controlled, from my perspective, by a corporate world that defines what they want us to see and how they want us to think about what the world is like, that I don't think is reality. On the other hand, I see things happening, whether it is in music or art or film, especially small independent film and other places, the cultural interaction, community level, where the power of black culture is in a different place than it was in 1930, consciously even. So I'm curious what you think about the difference between then and now and representation and where it's taken. Because things aren't static. They didn't stay the same. Things are not like they were in 1930, they can't be. That's not how existence works. So where do you think we are? And where do you think we're going?
I'm trying to be optimistic. That's why I'm hesitating.
Well, I mean, I have levels of optimism and pessimism about this. And I try to be as a pragmatic realist often. You know, people say, what are your policies? I say, I'm a pragmatic revolutionary. Because I know what has to be, but I also know where we are and what we got to do. Yeah. So, you know, you. So I'm just finding out in that sense, whether it's pessimistic, optimistic, doesn't have to be either.
I guess part of me feels that what we see happening now with, let's say, the music industry is very similar to what we saw in the 30s. When you think about the popularity of ragtime and jazz, and you look at where those started, right? If you position them in the black community, then you see that those became popular forms, very, very popular forms of music listened to universally, which is what's happening with hip hop. And then you complicate hip hop with the criminalization of hip hop and the incarceration of black men and how you make that more attractive, because you shifted from the 1970s of it being revolutionary, social movement, bringing communities together, to a criminalization. But in terms of, so looking at playwrights, so it is definitely, we had this whole conversation looking at women playwrights for the Crimes of the Heart panel discussion.
Right.
I would say things are better. Things are definitely better for black playwrights. I know more black playwrights now. I know more of the names of black playwrights. I've seen the black productions than people would in the 1930s, 1940s, 50s, 60s, except for the Black Arts Movement. But So I feel that that's better. But I think that, so when I look at the 1930s to 2014 and moving forward, I do think it's better. Whether we're doing it differently because we have social media, so the conversations are happening 24/7, it feels like, and people are held accountable for their actions in a way that they just weren't before. Their names are more visible. Their faces are more visible. You can't really hide your... I just read this story about the Clippers.
Oh, I saw that this morning. Oh, my God. The guy who owns the Clippers, what's it?
Basketball
manager. That was insane.
And he's married, and his half Latina, half black girlfriend had a picture with Magic Johnson. And he said, don't bring in to my games anymore. But he said the word, obviously. And he's, like, chiding her and saying, I don't want you to bring, I'll say African-American. I don't want you to bring African-Americans to the games. You can sleep with them.
Right.
You can talk to them. But I don't want anyone thinking that we associate with them.
Keep it private. Don't make it public.
Keep it private. Don't make it public. This is his girlfriend.
She's black.
Mixed-race girlfriend. Right. She's mixed race. And this is black, so this was public. And so, again, so our transgressions are no longer hidden. Oh, we can't even get into that because that gets into our tribal, our Native American communities. That's a whole other issue of grandstanding. So where is it going, right? So how do we move forward? But I think one of the things that I think that we can start doing is that this is not about privilege. We're talking a lot about recognizing white privilege, recognizing privilege. I walk into a room with a great deal of privilege all the time. What it is about is dismantling white supremacy. Because all white people don't walk into the world with automatic privilege. There are some white people who I have more privilege than they do. So, but it's white supremacy is a scary, scary name. So it's a word. So it's hard to get people talking about it on a more regular basis. Privilege is safer, but it's not active. So we have to start dismantling those systems, those systematic racist viewpoint that everything starts white. So, for instance, Noah, the boat. The Bible? Noah.
Yeah.
There's this movie, Noah, that I didn't even know about until I didn't know about it until the Marie, don't laugh at me. So cut that out from the little movie clip. So it's cast with all white people. And the screenwriter said, oh, we talked about it, and we thought that if we peopled it with people of color, it would just get complicated, right. And it would start to look like the Star Trek Enterprise, and that would be the focus, just in the same way that the focus is, did that boat really float? Could they really build it?
He should have just said nothing.
He should have just said nothing. I know. Keep it on the page, Frank, keep it on the page. So he said, white is universal. And this is a myth we're telling. White is universal. White is all. And that right there is what we have to walk away from, what we
but
have to dismantle.
But that's what's still consistent. That's why we can't call ourselves post-racial.
Oh, no.
Because we're still dealing with these very subtle, insipid, invisible methods that are embedded into our society that remind us time and time again that we aren't at the table in the same ways that others are. And so when I think about where we were in the 30s to where we are now, I would say in terms of having more people behind the scenes that are able to direct films, able to be creative, be the creative minds behind films, we see more of those individuals. But again, they're still gatekeepers who are making decisions about whether or not their films are worthy or not to make it to the big screen. And that in itself, again, reminds us that our stories are not a part of the universal story that can be told, certainly about Americans, because some people still believe that we are the black story. We are a part of that marginalized group discussion conversation, and we can only have that conversation when we are talking about race, but not to put us at the center of what the reality is. I mean, and this is one of the things that I talk about all the time. In every single class that I teach, I say to my students that even a black hair and body politics class that I teach once a year, that is the American experience. No, I'm not going to teach it just in Africana studies because that experience is American.
Thank you.
And I want it to be at the center and a part of the conversation of what being American is. And so to push it to the sides and say it can only reside in a particular space already allows me to acknowledge that it's marginalized.
Right.
And I'm not going to marginalize that voice because it deserves to be at the center of a conversation about the American lived experience.
Amen.
think it's interesting because I'm still sitting with this question as well, and I'm taking in the context the comments that you've both made. And I want to think about how the something about the narrative of the 1930s and the narrative today that is actually still the same. And if we think about the example that Lynn Ottage gives us in the play, there's an incredible amount of romanticism that is present in those stories, right? This sort of very sentimental, overly heroic, the relationship is all right kind of narrative that is presented in the film version that we see. And then if we fast forward that today, I think that we have changed a lot of the terms, but the narrative is still the same, right? I think reaching for even something like the post-racial, I think is still attempting to say we are all right in some way, that somehow, because we've arrived at a place where we don't see differences or don't have to deal with difference, then we're okay. And I think that there's something that's problematic there, and I think... Because there's a particular type of utopia, I think, that is present in both of those narratives. And I think the complicated thing, of course, about the idea of the post-racial is that it stems from post-black, which is an art term, which in itself was an acknowledgement of the type of the way in which the term itself was an oxymoron, right? It's a term that was created by black artists whose work was deeply invested in and steeped in notions of blackness, but who did not want to be defined as black artists or who did not want to be called black artists, right? So it's that same conversation of saying, no, we are a part of this American story.
Right.
And so when you, so because the term itself says that this such a thing does not exist, it's playing in that place of yes and no. Whenever we say we're in a post-racial society, the big joke is that the term itself announces that we are not mm-hmm. there. It is mm-hmm. a fantasy of a utopia that has mm-hmm. not yet arrived. And the thing about utopias is they never arrive, and when they do,
exactly.
they crumble.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think one of the other things that stands out to me in terms of 30s to present day, I would say, and I don't want us to forget that, would be the pain that Vera Stark experienced in her time of trying to be in Hollywood, I think would be very similar to what many black women would say is their pain
absolutely.
And experience of present day.
Absolutely.
And so, and you can hear that pain. And of course, we're not going to hear everyone expose all of what they may have to deal with on a daily basis in Hollywood, but you hear the pain when you listen to the acceptance speeches of black women when they win awards, right?
Absolutely.
So if we think about Hallie's speech, if we think about Whoopi's speech, if we think about Hattie McDaniel's, if we think about Lupita's recent speech, mm-hmm. all of them have a particular message that remind us of the pain that they have experienced in their journey in Hollywood. And I'm not sure if we are at a point that that has altered or changed to a point where they don't have to reflect on that pain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Lupita's speech focusing on beauty says something to us about the pain she mm-hmm. has experienced of being a woman trying to be in this business and yet people reflecting upon her of what her beauty is or is not in 2014,
yes.
right? So I think the pain of these black women is important to embrace and understand because I'm not sure that we are post that either.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I haven't had a chance to see the play yet, so I'm looking forward to that in a couple of weeks. But just a comment about her question. You touched upon the political correctness in the examples you just gave before that are really everything's so real so quickly in terms of films, TV, social media, the news, etc. It seems like that theater may be a place where you can get to that realness, that authenticity that you're speaking about maybe better than some of these other places because of the commercialism that's behind movies, etc. So just an observation and a question about the impact of theater in dealing with representation and race.
That's a great question. Why don't you start?
Oh, no, she's ready.
Go ahead. She is. Go ahead, Kimberly.
In another life, I was creative enough to be in the theater, but clearly not in this life. But I love theater, so I'm always present. And I would agree that I think it is a space that allows us for having those deeper conversations and talking about these types of issues in another way. But then I hear that, but then I reflect back on the comments that I hear from students of theater, who come and talk about not being given access to certain parts, right? Or not being or being reminded they have to play a role a particular way based on what someone believes blackness looks like. And so as much as I want to believe that that is that space, I certainly believe it's the space more than any other space. I don't think it is the epitome of the spaces that we're talking about. It's not that utopia that we're speaking of, because there are still some challenges there. It's human beings at the table. So, of course, it's going to be some of that baggage they bring to the table in terms of the experiences of what stories are being told and how they're being told. And so I think there are still some complications there, but it is a space or an arena I think is very supportive of us having these deeper conversations.
I would agree. And I would say that it's a much better space than Twitter. Okay, Twitter is the most powerful force that we have, and also the most dangerous force that we have. The thing that about theater is that it takes about 2 years for a play, one to be written, developed, shopped around, and produced. So that thing that was so urgent, passionate, and relevant that took me, 3 months to write and research, it's not even going to be seen, for another 2 years. So that's one of the challenging things about it being in theater. But I think that. Yes, we're all of us as artists, there's nothing more special about us than anyone else. We have our own baggage, issues, prejudice, all of that. So it does make it challenging to get our voices out there. But I do feel that theater is that realm to have this kind of dialogue. And then you can do community engagement programming around it to deepen the dialogue even further and bring on experts to talk about it and informative audience members to talk about it and then carry it home and say, I just saw this play, you have to go see it, and you've got to write a blog about it or something like that. I mean, I do think that theater is the place for that to happen.
Yeah, and also because theater for me is a community-based initiative, really,
yes,
and
yes.
That each audience is its own community.
Yeah.
And so when you bring a community of folks together and you give them a particular charge,
right.
I think that's part of the power of how theater can sort of handle immediate issues, even if it's not as immediate as
right.
it was
two years ago.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm Shirley Dunlap. I am associate professor at Morgan State University, and I head up the theater program there. But I do not recall the panelist in the second act doing the gyrations that they did. And so, as most of you know, I'm a director, so therefore I would like to, because we have not talked about the director's interpretation of the script, and I think that's very important. Also knowing Walter Dallas, and that Walter Dallas even said, I enjoyed, I had fun, it was great to be zany again after we had, we didn't Twitter, we Facebook back and forth in his last production in Arizona. So I think that's important to understand. I brought a friend with me, and I did not share because I was very nervous. I knew that the beginning of the play was part of a rehearsal, and we had just experienced someone calling him a good boy when we walked in. So we had to deal with all of that and then be confronted with this opening scene. And it was kind of challenging. It was very challenging for us because sometimes it does call for explanation, and sometimes you do not want to laugh at it because that not funny. So I found that to be interesting. Also, some of my students came to see it, so they knew. They said, it was interesting who laughed when and why. So I thought that was very interesting. But there was an article about a man who was grazing his animals on government property, and he talked about how they should be, continue to be slaves or whatever that case was.
He said they were. He said they, black folks would be happier as slaves.
Right.
Families would be better as slaves. They had stronger families than slaves.
Right.
They just need to learn how to pick cotton. They have forgotten how to pick cotton. That's
right.
What he said.
And this is,
so
yeah, that's
you want to respond to before we have to close out?
Well, I feel like I did respond. I responded just in the sense of I feel that what this production allowed, because I have the script here. Catherine, don't forget, I'm giving it to you. And I reread it, and I was like, that wasn't written in the script. So that became a moment for me, a continuation of the stereotypes of race representations that we're still seeing. So for me, it reminded me that it hasn't ended. Not that I needed to remind, but it just hasn't ended. That's what it did for me.
Yeah, and I also saw the second stage production, and in this production, my reading of the work that Walter Dallas did in the second act is that he embraced the fact that it's a send-up, that both acts, one and two, are a send-up. And I think that, for me, it felt like he took the nozzle and he kind of cranked it up a little hotter so that we can actually see how much there's a parody of these types of conversations. There's a parody of this situation. And so you're absolutely right. Because Karen Olivo, I do not remember rolling around on the floor.
Well, first of all, let's thank Jeff Lawton, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Otis Cortez, Ramsey Zoe for being here, and for all of you for coming here to our Word of the Play. It's wonderful to have you all with us. Thank you so much. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.